Brother Kelly had a menacing look in his eye as he entered the classroom. A lovely poem about Christmas for you today, boys. You're all going to enjoy this one, even you, Delaney. He fixed Delaney with a glare that managed to dare him not to like the poem, but also hinted at the punishment that lay ahead if he succeeded in not liking it. Right, lads, let's go. Page 248, A Christmas Childhood by Patrick Kavanagh. Come on, let's get stuck in. Modern teaching methods favor a gentle approach to the study of poetry that involves discussion of the potential learning outcomes. But Brother Kelly's method was more direct. It was simply to get stuck in. Poems were like opposition players on the GAA pitch. They were to be tackled, wrestled to the ground, and subdued. Once the poem was incapacitated, the reader dissected it and removed its vital organs, designated by Brother Kelly as the three T's: theme, tone, and technique. So we got stuck in. It took me only a few lines to realize that A Christmas Childhood was beyond me. Rather than being stuck in, I was just stuck. If ever there was an example of the rural-urban divide being an impediment to comprehension, this was it. One side of the potato pits was white with frost. How wonderful that was, how wonderful. I was a Dublin lad, and all the talk about potato pits being white with frost was wasted on me. I'd never seen a potato pit. For me, potatoes, and pretty well everything else I ate, came from Nolan's supermarket down the road and just appeared magically on my plate. A few lines further on, Kavanagh mentions ricks of hay and straw. The light between the ricks of hay and straw was a hole in heaven's gable. What exactly was a rick, I wondered? And what was the difference between hay and straw? Were they not the same thing? Weren't they both food for cattle? And equally mysterious, what was all this about Cassiopeia? Cassiopeia was over Cassidy's Hanging Hill. I looked, and three whin bushes rode across the horizon, the three wise kings. I'm not sure if the term light pollution had been coined in the mid-1970s, but the efficiency of the street lighting in Clontarf was such that my familiarity with the night sky was practically zero. To the 12-year-old literary critic in me, Kavanagh's verse seemed sadly deficient as a Christmas poem. No mention of turkey, no plum pudding, no presents. Instead, the unfortunate child poet was forced to listen to his father play the melodeon. Across the wild bogs, his melodeon called to Lennons and Callans. As I pulled on my trousers in a hurry, I knew some strange thing had happened. Yet despite the frost-bitten potatoes and the lack of presents, Kavanagh did seem happy. But what the strange thing was that had happened on that Christmas morning, I could only guess. One of the nice things about getting older is that sometimes you discover that the poem that went right over your head in your youth has been patiently waiting for you to revisit, like an old childhood friend. More than 20 years after I first encountered Kavanagh's poem, I found myself one Christmas evening walking carefully down a boreen in Connemara, carrying a baking tray containing a large roasted turkey. The oven in my in-law's house was too small to fit all the components of our Christmas dinner, so our neighbor up the hill, who was spending a few days at his sister's, had given us the use of his oven. It was one of those December nights when the Connemara sky is silky black and the stars look like gems that have spilled across the heavens. As I rounded the final bend in the Boreen and cleared a small clump of trees, a distinctive M-shaped constellation in the sky to the northeast over the 12 bends came into view with startling clarity. I realized with a kind of elation that I was walking towards Cassiopeia. And for a second, I felt that if I just kept on walking, I might somehow reach it. If the Star of Bethlehem had been half as beautiful, I could easily understand why three wise kings had decided to set out on their journey. Kavanagh's poem came back to me, and I hoped that at that moment, across in Monaghan, someone else was observing the same miracle over Cassidy's Hanging Hill. And though tempted to keep walking, I reminded myself that I was carrying a 16-pound turkey. And as another poet said on another occasion, I had promises to keep. As I placed the turkey on the kitchen work surface to cool, I could have sworn I heard the sound of a melodeon. The poem was still running through my head. But no, it was my father-in-law in the next room, playing softly on the mouth organ, a mournful version of Silent Night. All of this occurred more than 30 years ago. I don't remember what presents were exchanged that Christmas or what the pudding was like, but I do remember walking towards Cassiopeia. And I do remember my father-in-law's music. And I remember realizing, like Kavanagh on that Christmas morning, that some strange thing had happened.
McBurney's and Pym's were the first stores in Dublin to have a moving Christmas window display. I was 3 at the time, and I can still see it clearly now. It was a train with a monkey sitting by the chimney. The train was carrying presents of all shapes and sizes, wrapped up in coloured paper and tied with ribbons. Santa was on the train with his sack, which was filled to the brim. And the creator of this spectacular display was none other than my father, Tom Powell. And he had brought me into town to be the first spectator of his window creation. The year was 1953. Tom was a very talented display artist, and he seemed to love the creativity of the job. As a young man, he worked in Brown Thomas and was for a period of time working with the artist Nora McGuinness. She was head of display, and it was under her direction that he honed his skills in the art of window dressing. Nora was born in Derry and studied at the Metropolitan School of Art, now NCAD. She was a theatre designer as well as a painter, and in 1950, she and Nano Reid represented Ireland in the Venice Biennale. What was not so widely known is that for 3 decades she designed the windows for Brown Thomas's on Grafton Street in Dublin. She didn't just fill the window with merchandise. Each of her elegant displays told a story. Her philosophy was, less is more. After a few years, my father moved to Hickey's, the fabric shop in Henry Street. In those days, it was the practice to move from one retail establishment to another in order to gain experience and promotion. Dublin was a small city at that time, and staff members from the various shops socialised in the pubs like the Palace Bar in Fleet Street, the Elbow Inn and the Tower Bar in Henry Street, not to mention Davy Burns and McKeough's off Grafton Street. Through this grapevine, my father was asked by a member of the College of Art to give evening classes on the art of display. What he didn't know was that Nora McGuinness was a teacher in the college and had recommended he be headhunted for the job. Unfortunately, the opportunity was denied him, as Hickey's wouldn't allow him to serve two masters. However, he certainly made his presence felt in Hickey's. One of his window displays captured the theme of the then popular Forsyth saga. His setting for this one was a vintage car, filled with the mannequins dressed as the characters of the TV saga. Their clothes, of course, were fashioned from the fabrics of Hickey's. My father had intended the display to rotate, but unfortunately, the car was too heavy to allow the floor to move. Even so, the display was another showstopper. His vision was always ahead of his time. Nothing was safe as a prop for his windows. I remember on one occasion recognizing my bike, resprayed, partly dismantled, with Hickey's fabrics draped lovingly over it. One of the display staff at Hickey's years later told me if my father didn't like the display, he would turn to them and say, "It's not talking to me." And they would have to rework the display and ask, "Is it talking to you now, Mr. Powell?" Well, this Christmas, I'm remembering how he created the magic of Christmas for my three-year-old self. And do you know that magic has remained? I'm a child again, each and every Christmas. I'm going back to 1953. Standing outside McBurney's, he's asked me to keep an eye on the lights in the window. I'm to tell him if and when the lights go on. "The lights are on, Daddy," I shout. "The lights are on." My heart glows as the passers-by burst into a round of applause, and the voice of the newspaper vendors at the ballast office at the corner of Westmoreland Street are ringing in my ears, "Heddle a mail our evening press." Tomorrow, my wife and I will put up our Christmas lights in our front garden. My grown-up self will stand there waiting for the magic to fill our garden. And every day from here will be the wonderful sacred journey to Christmas for me. Here's to you, Tom Powell, my real Father Christmas. Thank you.
In the 70s and 80s in communist Hungary, I never knew the festive season to start before December. There were no singing Santas in the shop windows, wiggling their hips to Christmas tunes. Melodies of the season were not drifting in the air to lure in passers-by. In my childhood, December would approach quietly. The only sounds you'd hear were the crunch of fresh snow under your cold feet and the cracking of ice over frozen puddles. At home, there was a large wardrobe that stood unlocked all year, with the key projecting from the door. But in early December, the key would mysteriously disappear, making the wardrobe impenetrable, its contents safe from prying eyes. Somehow, my sister would always manage to find the key in some nook of the house. Then she'd say to me with a satisfied smile, "I know what I'm getting for Christmas." I, on the other hand, always preferred not to know. My parents liked to buy me practical stuff for the most part, things I needed anyway, a new pair of boots or a winter jumper. But they also wanted to give me a gift for its own sake. "What would you like for Christmas?" "I'd like a surprise." A rather unsatisfactory response for my parents, who didn't have time for guesswork. My mother especially would not want to waste hard-earned money on something I wouldn't like. For me, however, a surprise encapsulated the magic of Christmas. Traditionally, in Hungary, we'd put up the tree on Christmas Eve, the same day presents were exchanged, not one day before. To this day, I don't know how my father managed to get our 9-foot-tall spruce tree home from the market. We had no car, and home delivery service was unheard of. I did see local men carrying trees on the bus, then laboriously dragging them home through the snow-covered streets. In those pre-global warming days, white Christmases were practically guaranteed. In Hungary, Christmas Eve is the most important date in the festive season, and the only day in the year when Hungarians traditionally eat fish, usually roast carp. But one year, for a change, my father decided to bring home a pike. The pescatarians amongst you will know that the pike is a large carnivorous fish with many spiky teeth. Cutting the fish into 4 pieces, my mother happened to place her index finger into its mouth. Next thing we knew, she was bursting out of the kitchen, brandishing the head of a dead fish clamped to her finger, loudly beseeching my father to come and rescue her. Not exactly the scene for Silent Night. She spent the rest of that Christmas with a heavily bandaged finger and a painful look on her face. However, she came out of it much better than the unfortunate pike. Christmas Eve was truly a magical time in our house because, as if under a spell, objects essential for the festivities kept disappearing. After turning the shed upside down, my father would finally locate the tree base. Concurrently, my sister and I would be looking for the one long extension cord that the family possessed. As tension was rising, the Christmas spirit was going in the opposite direction. Eventually, after a struggle, my father would succeed in getting the giant spruce into the living room. At this point, he'd plug in our 2 sets of electric lights to test. And of course, there would always be the one faulty bulb in each set. "Do we have any spare bulbs?" Another frantic search. Once the lights were sorted, my sister and I would begin to decorate the tree. We'd marvel at our favorite decorations and welcome them back as old friends. I would carefully pass them to my sister, who was standing on a stool to reach the upper branches. To speed up the process, one year our father threw an audio cassette into the room for us to listen to while decorating. It was the latest album of C.C. Catch, a German disco singer who sang in English, hugely popular in Hungary in the 80s. My sister and I were delighted. We continued our work hip-wiggling and singing to the music blaring out of the speakers of our cassette player. We are living in a heartbreak hotel. That's about as much as we knew of the lyrics. The tree would shape up nicely as more and more sparkly baubles, twinkly figurines, and shiny Christmas candies were hung on its branches. Our mother would peep in now and again. When she finished her cooking, she'd urge us to finish up and to go into the other room to watch television. About an hour later, the chime of a crystal bell would call us back into the living room. Heartbreak Hotel was changed to Csendesi, the Hungarian version of Silent Night. The solemn notes floating off our only Christmas vinyl, twirling on the record player. We would all sing along. I remember the excitement and the joy in my heart as I looked at the tree. It was beautiful. I would look at my family. After all the mayhem, they were all relaxed and smiling. I would scan the boxes in shiny wrapping paper stacked under the tree. I would rest my eyes on the largest. Being the baby of the family, I knew this was for me. Christmas had happened already. Whatever was in the box was secondary.
"1974. I'm 3 weeks old. We're living with my auntie Cuddles. I'm my parents' first child, and it took them 3 years to get me, so I imagine they're very pleased. I'm wearing a yellow and white snowsuit with fur. We go to my granny's for Christmas. I'm surrounded by family. 1974. He's almost two. His parents run a clinic in the countryside in a town called Aguilares, where they are mostly paid in chickens. They spend Christmas in his granny's, his abuela's house in San Salvador. Following the big party on Christmas Eve, his abuela brings the grandchildren to Mass in the Nativity Church in downtown San Salvador. 1981, I am seven, my sister is five, and my brother's two. There's a photo of us under the Christmas tree. We have sleepy eyes and wild hair and fluffy pajamas. My dad is in the photo. He looks quite cool with his beard and his bushy hair. There are presents all around us. However, this Christmas is almost derailed by the disappearance on Christmas morning of my rabbit beauty. All that's left are tracks in the snow. On Stephen's Day, we opened the door to find my now late cousin Eamon, then in his early 20s. His eyes are streaming and his jacket bulging. Struggling inside his jacket are a white rabbit and a white guinea pig. He got them from a friend, and even though he's allergic, he wrapped them inside his jacket and walked to our house in order to save Christmas. Eamon, always a little bit wild and always awfully kind. 1981, he is eight, his brother is 11. He's been in Cuba for 2 months, having fled both civil war-torn El Salvador and civil war-torn Nicaragua, and having been chased out of Venezuela by the secret police because of his mother's political work for the FMLN, the left-wing alliance fighting the American-backed right-wing government in El Salvador. Both his uncle and his grandfather have been murdered by death squads, and his father has been fighting as a guerrilla in the mountains of northeast El Salvador for a year. There's no official celebration of Christmas in Cuba, but they are gearing up for big New Year's celebrations. 1996, I am 22. My nan is not well on Christmas Day. She's sitting in my aunt's house in a red dress. Just after Christmas, she's admitted to hospital. We spend those days between Christmas and New Year's visiting her. She dies on New Year's Eve. Everybody comes back to our house as it's the closest, and my mum has made a stew, a seemingly magic stew that stretches and stretches until there are more than 20 people silently eating stew in our kitchen. My auntie Kit, who is dishing it up, makes sure to give the vegetables to the women and children and keep the meat for the men. That night, I see my dad cry for the first time. My nan was a brilliant cook, and we were often sent to her door to ask her had she cooked anything nice. No more soda bread, my dad says. 1992, he is 19. After a 14-year exile, he's back in El Salvador, surrounded by uncles, aunts, granny, cousins, and his father, who he has not seen for 11 years. It's overwhelming to him to be surrounded by family again. The last time his abuela saw him, he was a chubby 10-year-old. Now he's skinny and tall with long hair, and not all of them recognize him. There's a very fragile peace in the country. There are fireworks. The great Mexican singer Tony Camargo is on the record player. Yo no olvido el año viejo porque me ha dejado cosas muy buenas. I don't forget the old year because it has left me many good things. 2012, I am 38. There's quite a few parties. A Damien Dempsey gig at Vicar Street, which became an after party, an after after party, an after 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 party, which left Christmas Day a hungover haze. But I am committed to writing a play for the first time, a play about swing dancing. So I researched swing dancing classes and I resolved to start in the new year. 2012, he's 39. He's living now in Dublin. His marriage has broken down and he has to again remake his life. He's living in a bedsit in Artane and he's been going swing dancing. There's a Christmas party in the workman's with all the swing dancing community. It is in this room that we will meet and dance together for the first time. 2018, we're in our home. Our three-year-old is amazed by his presence. Santa is so kind, indeed. We have breakfast in our home. We go to my parents for dinner. All our grandparents are gone. Our parents have now joyfully become the grandparents, and we are the parents. Afterwards, he picks up his two older sons, my stepchildren, and we have a party. Party now means we make Lego and eat chicken goujons and sweets. 2019. Well, Christmas Day is yet to come. Pero yo no olvido el año viejo, porque me he dejado cosas muy buenas. Ay, como gozo. But I don't forget the old year, because it has left me very good things. There is joy.
Before everything, I want to say happy Christmas to you, all of you, a happy new year.
Thank you so much.